Welcome to this week's Made in Scotland podcast, sponsored by Ogilvy Ross. I'm Gary Robinson. This week's guest spent 28 years as the headmaster of Craig Clowan School in Perthshire, here in Scotland. Following his retirement in 2007, he became president of the Perthshire Chamber of Commerce. And since then, worked with and was the chairman of Peak Leaders UK, a training company once again based here in Scotland, on the management board of Algo, and the list goes on. I love this mic where it starts to get a little bit exotic about appraising and business development, working with a ski school in France. That sounds good. And the list goes on, and you're still very, very active in and around the community of Perth and Perthshire. Thank you for joining me.
You're welcome.
And let's just talk about. I want to go back first, just to have a brief view on your upbringing, your childhood, because it's where we start with all our guests. And just wondered, you know, how was your childhood for you? Was it idyllic? Was it full of memories, or was it not?
No, my childhood was very conventional. My father was a policeman. My mum was mum and worked, but largely looked after the house. I was brought up, I suppose, in an age when parents and society generally respected teachers and policemen and clergymen and doctors in a way that's slightly different now. So I was expected to behave. I was often reminded that my father was a policeman, so look out. But my childhood was very, very conventional. I was lucky in that my parents recognised that the particular talent that I seemed to have needed to be nurtured. I wasn't academic. I learnt a big lesson as I grew up that no doors should be closed to the apparently non-academic child. And that helped me enormously when I went to Craig Clowan, because boys are often slower in developing and so on. And so I was 19 before the academic switch switched.
So in your school years for primary and secondary then, did you excel in anything in particular? Were you particularly sporty?
Oh, give me a ball.
Right.
Give me a ball. I was really lucky in that I seemed to have a talent for cricket, and it was recognised really early on. So in both the secondary schools that I attended, because I went to two because my father as a policeman was moved, both realised that I could play, and I ended up playing professional cricket when I was still at school, playing England schools and all that sort of thing. And that took over from the work, but actually the lesson I learnt was that it helped me enormously later on in my career. It opened many doors. So I played cricket to a high level, I played hockey to a high level, and then I've dabbled at rugby, football and badminton, and I try and hit a golf ball now.
But you don't become the headmaster of one of the country's leading schools without some nous, I would say. So what was that leap? Did you leap into education sort of shortly after your teenage years, or did that come after a while, or
no,
was it a period in industry?
It came almost as I left school, bearing in mind that I was 19 when I left school, because the school was really sensible and recognised, as I did subsequently, that boys take longer. So I took what was my A-levels when I was 19 and got reasonable A-levels, then went to university and trained as a teacher. So I was going to go into schools, although I had a slight temptation to become a policeman.
Right.
But that didn't actually last long. So I went to a school, which was a sporty school. It was a boys' independent school. I was there for 9 years. I got several promotions. And one day I got a letter from a school in the South, Millfield, some people will know the name, inviting me for interview for the headship of their prep school. And I hadn't applied.
So headhunted?
Well, the application was put in by a parent of mine, of a boy who I was teaching, who I'd helped quite a lot. And he always said to me, you should become a prep school head. And I just was very happy doing what I was doing. But actually, having been for the interview, I then thought, maybe there's something in this. And Craig Clowan came up very soon after I applied, and age 32 was appointed. So the academic jump came in the time between school and university. I studied economics at university.
One question that we ask all our guests, well, all the questions are quite similar, Mike, but what inspired you to go into teaching? You talked about maybe dabbling, you know, following in your father's footsteps, and then that was sort of knocked to the curb a little bit, kicked to the curb. So, but what inspired you to go into the world of teaching, which is obviously an admirable profession?
I often think these things come by chance, and I was playing cricket at a reasonable level. A friend of mine with whom I played was a member of staff at Downside Abbey School, and the job became available. It was an economics and politics job. So why don't you have a look? So I did. And I had done a Bachelor of Education, so I was qualified, and so I fell into it. And I fell into that like I fell into the prep school world, where I found that I really liked having children aged 3 to 13 in my care, and I seemed to be able to do it. So luck, for me, was a very important thing.
And obviously seeing young people develop and grow must be a very rewarding...
Oh, it's great, isn't it? I mean, I virtually every time we go out anywhere, there were 1,800 students went through our hands whilst we were at Craig Clown. And most of them are grown up now. I mean, the oldest are now 50. So, you know, they've got children of their own, and I often see former pupils and their children, and see many parents. Every Wednesday, I play golf with three of my parents.
Right, really? That's good. You still keep in touch. That's good.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah.
We're talking about leadership as well within this series of Made in Scotland, and you've been at the helm, being a leader for many years in and out of education. What do you think are the prerequisites that, you know, in terms of a leader's quality or qualities, what should they have? What should they be bringing to the table?
I've often thought about that. And I think there are some straightforward ones and some not so straightforward ones. I think a straightforward one is being able to make a decision. And I think you're much better making a decision quickly than not making a decision slowly. And that the teams that you lead like decisions to be made, even if they don't agree with them, which often they may not. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is it's about building teams and not being afraid to employ people who are more able than you are. And the more able the team you're able to get together, the more likely you are to succeed.
Because leadership can be quite... people talk about it being lonely at the top, you know, when you're in charge, and I think there is a large degree of truth with that. But leadership can also be ego-led in some cases, and that can sometimes get in the way of perhaps building those teams. Do you think people, some potential leaders or people who are leaders now, might see bringing people into their team who are better than them at certain things as a threat?
Oh, yes, without doubt. But those are the ones that tend at some point to get into trouble. So I was always wanting to employ the best possible people that I could at school. And subsequently, in the other things that I've been doing, we are always looking for the best that we can find in the field and not worry if their skill levels are better than ours. I mean, it would be strange, I think, for someone of my vintage to be really, really good at social media, because I'm not, and I don't really understand it, but I'm really happy that I've got people who do understand it. I mean, databases is another thing that I don't really understand. But at the air ambulance, we have staff who really know what they're doing in those fields. And it's an enormous help.
And just tell us what you're doing with the Scottish Air Ambulance.
Oh, Scotland's charity Air Ambulance was started by three chaps back in 2007, 2008, me and two others, and we launched in 2013. We've flown 1,300 rescue missions since 2013. We operate from Scoon. We cover the whole of Scotland. We sounds a bit like an advert, this, but we raise £7,000 a day to fly the service. We employ 5 paramedics, 2 pilots. We now have an EC-135, which I describe as the Range Rover. We started with a Bolko, which, if anyone knows anything about helicopters, is a Land Rover.
Right, okay.
And we have a fundraising staff based at Scoon Airport.
£7,000 a day is a lot of money. There will be some significant challenges around that. What is your role within the organisation currently?
I'm the vice chairman, founding trustee and vice chairman. And I've just come here from a board meeting where the 8 trustees meet once a quarter to discuss all that you need to discuss in running a business. Because although it's a charity, you know, it's a £2.2 million a year charity, it's a business, it's a startup business, and all the risks that go with being a startup business. So we have been seeking sustainability for the last 2 to 3 years, and we're doing really, really well. And we're very grateful to the general public who are supporting us hugely.
And quite obviously, I would imagine it's because they see the benefit to the country of the air ambulance.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I suppose the message is that Scotland is very large in terms of geographical area. Its infrastructure is not strong. So north-south communication, east-west, are lots of rural areas, lots of mountainous areas, lots of people for whom a trip to hospital in an ambulance will be a matter of hours. Whereas we can get to 90% of the population of Scotland within 40 minutes. And if you think about the impact of the golden hour on recovery periods for seriously ill patients, then for us to get them to any one of the trauma hospitals in Scotland is a major, major boost for them. So it's we operate in time critical emergencies. That's our role. So it's a 999 call, a HEMS helicopter emergency service response.
So it was something that you started to discuss and start fundraising for in 2007, is that right, Mike?
2007, 2008, yeah.
And so in terms of the concept of the air ambulance, were you sat with your colleagues having a cup of tea or a pint and going, do you know what, Scotland needs an air ambulance? How did it come about?
We were sat in a coffee shop in Perth having a coffee, actually.
Right.
And it came out of a few meetings. I was president of the chamber at the time, and the other two fellows, one of whom has now sadly died, but were attending meetings from similar bodies. And we used to get frustrated that nothing much seemed to happen out of these meetings. So in a fit of pique, we sat down and said, right, we're going to do something which is going to be good. What should we do? A fourth person, who was a helicopter pilot, became involved because he knew what he was doing. And we sat and we said, right, well, let's try this. And so we set about raising some money, and we raised £300,000 in a month with no aircraft. But then, of course, we realised we had to get some permissions. So we spent the next 2 to 3 years discussing with those that needed to give permissions, so the health service, Scottish Ambulance Service, and so on and so forth. And although it seems like a long time, you know, if any organisation that has 3 middle-aged chaps coming saying, we've got a bright idea, will you do this with us? They're going to take some time to rationalise and look. And eventually they realised that we weren't going to go away and that we could actually do it. And you see, there are 32 air ambulances in England. There are 2 in Yorkshire alone. And there were 2 in Scotland. Okay, but they were predominantly not emergency helicopters. They were for routine transfers of patients who required routine treatment, whereas we are totally emergency system. And we've really enjoyed working with Scottish Ambulance Service, with the government and with the politicians in delivering 1,300 rescues in under 3 years.
What was the biggest challenge to getting the helicopter off the ground?
I suppose making sure that we had enough money this week to be running next week in the first instance. But that didn't last too long. Our major challenge now is sustainability of funding. But we're now much more secure, but still knowing that we have to raise £7,000
a day
to make it work. So in a business, that's always going to be a challenge, isn't it? The people of Scotland get the message that it could be them. So if you take, for example, the motorbike fraternity, if I'm speaking to groups just now, I ask them, no matter how old they are, do you ride a motorbike? Well, don't. Do you ride a horse? Don't. Do you ride a mountain bike? Don't. Because those are three major causes of our call-outs. You add to that heart attacks and strokes and road accidents, and those are our major reasons for being called out. It's very exciting.
I'm sure. And challenging and exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Yeah.
I want to go back to you, Mike, in terms of professional and personal. We're asking all our guests to share with us something that has at some point taken them into a dark place and how you've got through the other side. Because, you know, one thing that we talk about on the podcast again is about resilience. We talk about inspiration and motivation. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're all human. And I think it's really important that we hear stories, because it's things that we can then share and identify with. So would you be willing to share something with me and the listeners?
Sure. I don't want to disappoint you, but I've actually been really lucky. And the number of challenges that I've had in my life have been very small. I'll share two, if I may. The first one is not meant to be humorous, but actually, on reflection, is quite humorous. Was I used to help when at age 12, 13, I used to help my grandfather in his grocery shop. And he went bankrupt, which in late 1950s, 1960, was quite serious. I mean, it brought shame on the family and stuff. Well, obviously it didn't. But he went out on his rounds one day, left me with a bag of money to give to the Lions man. So the Lions cake man came in. I handed him the money. He was delighted. Pop came home later and said, "Did you pay the Lions man?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And with that, knock on the door, and the Lions ice cream man came, and I'd paid the wrong Lion. And the Lions ice cream company made my grandfather bankrupt. And that was always remained with me, that actually running a business and being involved in organisations, cash is really important. And that if you have cash, then you have some form of influence. So he, poor man, went bankrupt. He survived, but he went bankrupt. The second's more serious in a way, but has a happy ending, in that our eldest daughter lives in New Zealand, two delightful grandchildren. And 3 years ago, she contracted cancer. Now, cancer is difficult wherever, but 12,000 miles away is quite testing. And my wife and I had a really nice experience in that we took ourselves off one Wednesday afternoon to Maggie's in Dundee. And we were made very welcome. And we sat and we chatted with a lady who gave us endless time. And we talked through our concerns and some unanswerable questions. And we were made to feel much, much better. And fortunately, our daughter, who had a major operation, is now, well, she went back to work very, very quickly and is absolutely fine. But other dark moments have been few and far between.
On the flip side of that, could you share a high with me, something that stuck with you for a long time, something that gave you that, you know, fist pump moment and yes?
I suppose getting the Craig Lyon job was one. Seeing the aircraft fly was another. But I'll take you back to 1991. I applied for a Churchill Fellowship. Now, I would urge everyone to have a look at Churchill Fellowships. As once you become a Churchill Fellow, you become a Fellow for life. Just sticks with you.
Sorry to interrupt, Mike. Just for those who aren't aware, what is a church or fellowship?
Well, when Sir Winston Churchill died in 1965, there was a public subscription. And the idea was to fund time out for people to go and study and do something that they might otherwise never have the opportunity to do. So every year there are between 1,500 and 3,000 applicants for these fellowships. This year's applications are now open. There are 7 or 8 categories. So you apply and there's then a process which ends up with between 80 and 100 being awarded. And in 1991, I was awarded £6,000 to go to Australia and New Zealand to look at bullying in schools and universities out there. And that was a big moment for me because it enabled me to have a little bit of time out of school. So by that stage, I'd been the headmaster for 12 years. And my governors always said that refreshment was really important. And they gave me 3 opportunities during my time to go and do something different. So the award of a Churchill Fellowship was one. Definitely a fist-pumping moment when you get that letter to say you've come down to 80 from, in my case, 1,800. In 2001, I was awarded an English-speaking union scholarship to go to the United States. To look at, of all things, sex education as it was being operated in some schools in Florida and Louisiana. That was another major thing for me. And I suppose the other thing is being elected by your peers to be the chairman of the Incorporated Association of Preparatory Schools, you know, the 700 in the world, and they elect a chairman. And I was elected in 94. And it is very rare to be elected twice, and they saw fit to elect me again in 2005. So I had 2 years of doing that. So, you know, during my time at Craig Clown, I was very lucky to get all these opportunities to learn different things and see different parts of the world.
So you went out and you looked at bullying. Interesting you say universities, because when I sort of stood up a little bit and, you know, bullying in universities is something you don't necessarily think of. You think schools, you see it, but I suppose it can happen absolutely anywhere. So you went down there, you went over to America and looked at the teaching of sex education. And almost then, did you import some of those findings and teachings into Scotland?
Yeah.
And what were the key ones for bullying?
Well, the key ones for bullying is that bullying is endemic in society.
Right.
It's not a school issue. It is a school issue because it happens in school. But it happens in the home, happens in nurseries, it happens in the workplace, it happens in organisations. And therefore, to try and solve the issue simply by looking at schools is actually ignoring the problem. And All the inquiries that I did, both in Australia and New Zealand, confirmed what I knew back here was the case, that in order to solve the issues, you have to communicate, you have to involve everybody. You know, you have to involve the parents, and that's not always easy because they sometimes don't want to hear, particularly if the children involved are actually reflecting on what they see at home. And what they live at home. So the message is pretty clear that it's a societal problem. And businesses have to be really aware of the potential for that sort of thing happening within their four walls. So it was really interesting.
And what about the, in terms of the Scottish education system, what, you know, if we could export anything, I'm sure that we do, but, you know, what can we export to the rest of the world from our education system?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I can only speak from my own experience in my own school. I mean, I think that every single child has something that they're relatively good at. And the best schools try and find those things. You know, and it might not be maths and it might not be English. And it might be that the same child is really, really good at everything. But every child has some skill. And so school has to spend time by all means teaching maths and English, but also looking at the other things, be it music, be it drama, be it sport, it doesn't matter. But every child will respond to having success in another field. When I first became a head, I went to see a wise old head and I asked him for some advice. And he said, look, he said, what you've got to do is make your school really well known for two things, one inside the classroom, one outside the classroom. So I was very fortunate at Craiglaurin to employ a Frenchman called Patrick Bordery, who's a bit of a legend, a magnificent teacher of foreign languages. And we became very well known for that very quickly. And I also introduced skiing and built a dry ski slope and so on and so forth. And I won't apologise too much, but we won a lot of races. So we became quite well known. So when you've got those two things, you can then add to them. So you become very good at another academic subject and another extracurricular. And you build and build and build.
And obviously you worked in the private school sector. Do state schools have the time to do and the resources to do what you successfully did at Craiglaurin?
I don't know the answer to that. For me, the answer should be yes. I'm hesitating because my own theory is, and this is personal, this is me, is that many state schools have outstanding teachers. But the local authority system doesn't always release them to do what they're best at. Whereas I didn't have a local authority and therefore I was able to release them. So if it was really snowy, it was a really lovely day, we'd go to Glenshee. And we had that flexibility to do it.
And I see that you've brought a couple of books with you, which is terrific, because as you must have guessed that I was going to ask you a question about books, or indeed suggest a book that you think could change somebody's life. What have you got for us?
Well, I've got two. I've got a book by Justin Langer called The Power of Passion. Justin came to Craiglaurin to help me for a term in the late 1980s, before he became well known, played many, many test matches for Australia. Absolutely delightful person. And there are lots and lots of messages in his book which relate to cricket, but relate to managing business as well. And the other one is much more recent. It's called Legacy, 15 Lessons in Leadership, and it's about the culture of the All Blacks and how the All Blacks have created the culture of winning that they have, and what is that based on. And if I give you one message from Legacy, for example, there's a piece in it which says, who sweeps the sheds? Who does all those little things that need to be done? And the answer in that culture is that the most experienced, the most successful, the Dan Carters, the Richie McCaws, sweep the sheds. So they clear up in the changing room. And I think for children growing up to understand that they must treat everyone the same when they're on the way up, because sure as fate, they're going to meet them on the way down. And one of my favourite assemblies, which reflects that in a way, began with a title, Pigeon Today, Lamppost Tomorrow, which, one minute you're standing on top of the lamppost and you're king of the castle, and the next minute you're not. And so the most successful people recognise that, okay, they're in a good place just now, but actually they might not be the boss and they might like to be treated as they've treated others. So Legacy, it's by a chap called James Kerr, is one book. And Justin's book is probably all about character. And there's a piece in there which says, pick character over cover drives. You have this picture as a cricketer of someone flushing the ball through extra cover for four. he says that's great, but actually you want to pick the character of the person before the ability to do that. And there's a lovely poem in there, anonymous poem. It's about the man in the mirror. And it goes lots of lines. But actually what it says is that you can cheat in life. You can cheat your mum, you can cheat your friends, but actually when you look in the mirror in the morning, there's one person in life you can't cheat, is the man in the mirror. Two outstanding books.
One of them, obviously, legacy. What would you like your legacy to be, Mike?
I think that's a question you have to ask others. Not for me to say. I mean, I suppose I've always been hardworking. My parents are very hardworking. I've worked really, really hard. And I really like that. I wouldn't have had that any other way. So certainly the ability to work hard is one. I think I hope the air ambulance will be there for a long time after I'm not. But I hope that the children that came to us at Craig Clowan left us and remember us with some of those lessons that we've talked about. I have a wonderful moment. Often it's happened. Having a wee ski on a Tuesday, quiet ski now on a Tuesday, which I can do on my own, which is such a pleasure. And some former pupil will be walking down the car park carrying skis, will put down skis, rumble in the pocket, and they'll pick out a whistle, they'll pick out a blanket, and they'll pick out a bar of chocolate. And that's, I've still got them, Mike, I've still got them. So I suppose it's people who remember some of those lessons.
One more question before we get to your piece of music. We ask all our guests this, and what do you love about this country of Scotland and its people?
That's a good question. People often ask me, you know, whether I've ever been treated as an Englishman, which I am, Englishman with a kilt, whether I've ever felt anything other than a welcome in Scotland. I can truthfully say that I've never felt anything other than a welcome. I mean, occasionally when the Six Nations is on, there will be a little bit of hammer, a bit friendly hammer, where everyone wants to beat England. But I've never been made to feel anything other than welcome. I love the countryside. Angela, my wife, and I have walked maybe about half the Munros. We like the outdoors. We like the lack of traffic. Although having tried to get here from Perth, coming over Fryerton Bridge recently, or an hour ago, wasn't so easy. But the lack of traffic, the very long evenings. All of those things.
I've got to say, Mike Beale, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today, and thank you for your time. Before you announce the title and the artist of the song that you've chosen, I love this part of the podcast. Can you share with us why you've chosen this particular song, which I have to say, I love it too.
Good. Well, this comes from cricketing days. I was quite young and for a variety of reasons found myself captaining a semi-professional county team playing in the minor counties, and I was the youngest person in the team, and I thought, well, this is going to be a challenge. There were several who'd played test cricket and lots of other experienced cricketers, so I sat them down before we started and said, look, we're going to sort out here what our way of working is going to be. Okay, they said, fine, what do you want? I said, well, I want us to work in a no blame environment. And by that, I mean, we all try our very best. And if we get it wrong, which we will, and I will, and you will, we don't blame one another. We pick each other up and we think again. Okay. And we had this wonderful thing where we started at plan A in a game, bearing in mind games lasted 2-3 days. And we might end up with plan Z. And that became a bit of a joke. But at the time, Gerry Rafferty was obviously popular, as he remained popular. And so if you get it wrong, get it right next time. Mm-hmm.
The Made in Scotland podcast, sponsored by Ogilvy Ross, was produced by Chris Kidd for Gardine Studios and GRC.